You're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com, bringing you the freshest radio in Brooklyn since 2009. Hear directly from chefs to farmers, artists to architects, authors to brewers, and everyone in between. Check out all of our shows on our website or by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. The following program has been brought to you by Cane Vineyard and Winery. Cane Vineyard and Winery supports Heritage Radio and the growing movement to change how Americans eat and how we think about our planet. For more information, visit www.cane5.com.
They can hear you now, Jason.
Great. Great. I couldn't figure out that whole I have to take off my headphones to talk to you because the volume wasn't put in because you didn't want to talk over all of our sponsors, but I figured that out now. It only took six times, but...
Six times. Yeah. Good job. Well, we should say this is the main course.
Yes. I'm Jason Colucci here, guest hosting for Katie Kiefer.
I'm Patrick Martins, playing myself.
Yes, yes, yes. It's funny, when we came in here today, we were talking about restaurant power players, days off, in terms of management to servers.
Okay.
If you're a really good server.
So what's Sunday and Monday?
Sunday and Monday, you're probably middle management. You bang out Friday or Saturday, and you get 2 days off in a row. Sunday, Monday, relax and come and just pretty much rein in the restaurant for the week, and then just put out fires on Tuesday when you come back in.
Who's Tuesday, Wednesday?
Tuesday, Wednesday, front of the house. You've probably been there for a year. You're probably, you know, getting on a schedule, getting in a good rotation. You might work one brunch, but Tuesday, Wednesday, yeah, you're new. You're new, but you're good.
And you go to all your friends back from college. You're like, let's go to the beach this Tuesday.
Yeah, and they're like, you call your friends with 9-to-5s, and they're like, yeah, I gotta go to work.
Yeah. So Wednesday, Thursday, Friday.
Thursday, Friday
is like the owner.
Well, the owner under a big group or something. Well, if you're leaving Friday at noon and coming back Monday afternoon, you're a major player. And if you're flying a seaplane to the Hamptons or the West Side Highway to the Hamptons or something, you're a major player. But yeah, if you show up Monday and you're, you know, taking your shoes off and throwing out all the sand that is sort of crossover because you didn't go home, you went right to
work.
You're
bringing sand into the kitchen.
Yeah.
That is a very interesting breakdown of the restaurant industry. So from now on, anyone I meet in the restaurant industry, I'll be like, what days do you get off?
Without a doubt, you can pretty verbatim figure out where they're at.
And then they're like, do you want to know what I do? I'm like, I already do. You don't have to say anything. This is going to be a great show. This is the main course on the Heritage Radio Network. We broadcast out of Roberta's Restaurant. And today we'll have Jason Denton, who's a great restaurateur, on. Also Julia Jasek from Employees Only.
Late Night. Love that place. Industry. Yes. Industry.
Total of what great cocktails. And then Eastern European Charcuterie, which we're going to talk a little bit about. But before we start with Jason, I just wanted to... news to us is whoever supports Heritage Foods and they do something good, so that becomes news on the network. Emory University just received a gold rating in the Sustainability Tracking Assessment and Rating System, STARS, for its leadership and innovation in university sustainability. Emory's evaluation by STARS was based on a comprehensive list of credits in three major areas: education and research, operations and planning, and administration and engagement. Based on the percentage of credits earned in these three categories, universities are ranked platinum, gold, silver, and bronze. Of the nearly 170 schools that registered to participate in STARS, 69 have been ranked to date. Emory is one of just 14 to be rated STARS Gold, which is the highest rating achieved so far. So congratulations to our friend Julie Schaefer, who's been on the network, and they support the Heritage Turkey Project and local farms down by Emory in Atlanta. So gold rating for Emory.
Congratulations to you for memorizing that whole thing.
Yes, that was very good. Well, that's why I wake up at 2 a.m. on Sundays. Well, I guess without further ado, we should introduce one of the biggest guests the station has ever had.
Pretty big. I mean, the security alone was intimidating.
Yeah. I mean, Roberta's is closed right now until Jason leaves, and it'll be reopened. Well, I have an intro for Jason. Jason is an amazing restaurateur who got his start in San Francisco with his legendary uncle, who started many famous restaurants on the West Coast. In New York, he is the founder of Lupa Restaurant, Eno, Enoteca Uptown and Downtown, Corsino, and now Beto in Brooklyn. He's the first group of buyers of Heritage Foods USA product, a relationship that began in 2005 when we took a trip to Kansas together to meet a number of pig farmers. Jason Denton is the author of two books on panini, one of which I wrote the quote on the back of the book for, and as a result, I hear you can't keep it on the shelves, that book. Is that right?
It's pretty thick in here right now.
Thanks for coming on, Jason.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
So let's start a little bit at the beginning. What did you learn from your uncle? Because the famous Harry Denton, because I figured you learned a lot of what you know today through your uncle. So,
yeah, I mean, he really, well, first off, thanks for having me on. This is, you know, love the show and love to be a part of this. So thank you. He really kind of established just the way I look at the whole hospitality side of things from a young age, having him visit when I grew up in Idaho to when I first moved to San Francisco when I was 21. He really kind of established how, you know, you want to make guests feel and the reaction on their faces. And from the time I stepped foot into Harry Denton's on Stewart Street, he kind of had that real magic. When he walked into a room, everything just kind of lifted. The air was lighter. People just looked around and just the happiness. And what he kind of established was it's just so much about the moods and the foods and the time and the place and what goes on in there and how you don't necessarily need to make that big impact. You just kind of let the room kind of guide your way through it and feed off the energy that's in there. And that really allows you to kind of, you know, bring the breath in there.
So did you? He's a room changer. Did you gravitate more towards his energy or more towards the industry when you sort of?
He really kind of guided me into that, you know, and kind of, you know, established that I need to start learning about the food and the wine and that. But as far as, you know, motivation for getting in the restaurant business, just the pure joy I saw on people's faces when I was 21 years old and what he could do to a room just kind of parlayed into that.
Well, what is the grammar into making that energy? Because, like, there's restaurants like Balthazar, which is just, like, pouring electricity all over the place.
I mean, that place alone, whenever I have anyone in town who's never been in and you want to show someone magic, I mean, that place to me, the air, and when you walk in, it just kind of, it changes, you know, everything.
Mm-hmm. And Corsino I put on that level, you know, on really just being a fun place that people smile the second they walk in. It's part of the architecture, part of the food, part of the service. But what is that? What is that grammar? What's the secret to that? Is it just a big open room or?
I don't know. I think so much of it is the neighborhood and what the people bring to it in there. A lot of times with our restaurants, when we're opening or looking for different locations, you know, people talk about AAA location or this is a corner. So much of it for me is when you walk in and what the space says to you and then, you know, the neighborhood. Like a lot of our places, we're not looking to change the world as far as the food or the wine, but what we want to do is try to establish a neighborhood space that kind of really makes people feel good and want to come in there on a regular basis, whether it's for like a cappuccino and a glass of wine or whether they want to full on go off and do a tasting menu. We just want to make it that presence for every day.
And from the design perspective, is there a common thread between all the restaurants, like certain things that you do at each space to help achieve that?
Well, I think in our design, you know, most recently we had this guy come on board whose name's John Call, and he has Mr. Call Designs, and he's kind of looked at what we have done in the past and just kind of accented some of those things we look for. You know, a lot of my restaurants tend to be a little more rustic in style. You know, I don't know grammatically if this is correct, but like a casual Christmas. You know, we want people to have a real comfortable approach, but have all the information in their back pocket. So, you know, where are the animals from? You know, where this vineyard is, what vintage, you know, you name it. We want to have all the information, but approach it in a real casual way. So, it, you know, makes people feel comfortable.
Mm-hmm. Do you think finding a space and satisfying a customer base, do you, what are the harder things about New York City restaurants? You know, obviously negotiating leases and stuff like that, but it's something that pops out right away.
Yeah, I mean, for me, that stuff isn't the hardest part. The leases and that, it takes a while, but you know, you have key people who can help you execute that. For me, I think the biggest challenge day to day is just delivering a really high-level, consistent product and looking to exceed people's expectations. Because over the course of time, maybe Eno is an example. We've been there 13 years. How do you constantly try to improve and maintain the consistency? So you want to continue to grow and develop new things, but also you want people to know that when they come in there, they can get what they're looking for and maybe a little bit more. So just, I mean, the training's also a challenge too, because there's, you know, between kids going off to college and, you know, the rotation of the restaurants. My restaurants also happen to serve late night, you know, like Enotech is till 3 in the morning and the others are like 12 and 2. Those hours that put into people, you know, definitely take a toll on them. So as much as we love to have people work for a long time, it's a challenge because, you know, with school and everything, they've got to take care of themselves as well.
What about a relationship with chefs as a challenge to running restaurants in New York? I mean, how do you keep them focused to your view, but also allow them the freedom to, you know, bring new things to the table and express their creative
energies? Yeah, I mean, I think the most important thing with that is just really communicating. You know, a long time ago, going back to my uncle, when I was bartending and waiting tables, he kind of looked at me one day and said, "Listen, what do you want to do with your life?" I said, "You know, I want to open up a restaurant." And he said, "Well, then tomorrow you need to go into the kitchen, because unless you know everything about the kitchen or at least have a good interest in the kitchen and can go back there and help out, you're really no good to anyone in the restaurant business." So he's like, "What you need to do, focus on the kitchen and, you know, create a structure that's well-rounded, and it'll give you the best opportunity to succeed." So for me, back to that point, I communicate with the kitchen a lot. I love going to the market. We always talk about, you know, additions on the menu, what's seasonal. And, you know, in 2005, when I went with you and Mark Ladner and the guys to Kansas, that was amazing. Yeah. I mean, those are the kind of things that I thrive on. And I think the guys in the kitchen understand that. So it's a real passion that I have, everything food as well.
Yeah, no, I mean, that was a great trip. Remember, the van got stuck on the way to Larry Sorrell's.
That was amazing.
We had to get it pulled out by a tractor.
Who originated that trip? Was it just a general thing you Heritage organized, or was it before anything happened? Or
it was basically when Heritage Foods realized that it could not just pay the bills through being a mail order home delivery business, you know, to chefs around the country. We were like, we have to get into wholesale. And I had known Mark, I guess, and Jason through the Slow Food days, and they were like, "Well, let's go see if there could be some beef, some pork. Like, is there any type of business that could work out there?" And I knew some pig farmers, and that's how it started. And Ladner and Jason at the time were like, "If you can deliver Lupa for 6 months, then you can get other restaurants in the group, and you can grow." And we did, out of an unrefrigerated U-Haul, for which I shouldn't admit, but for the first 6 months.
Once we saw those little red waddles, forget it,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, they were just so damn cute. So now, you talking about difficulty, Jason, to your Jason Colucci, to your question, you were asking about difficulty challenges of running a New York City restaurant. What about sourcing? And, you know, you were saying something about the consolidation of the industry.
Yeah, I mean, in the past 2 months, a lot of companies that have, bigger companies and smaller companies have been eaten up. Some of them for, you know, maybe financial reasons. They really look between the lines. But, for example, a great purveyor for 20 years, SOS Chef, they closed for whatever reason. Ace Endico, which deals mostly, I think, with retail, purchased a smaller purveyor called Permizzi recently. Also, Chef's Warehouse Dairyland purchased Harry Wills, which is a landmark company, about 2 months ago, and then they went public. I just noticed a lot of consolidating of smaller companies, and it certainly rubbed me the wrong way, but it made me feel like everything in New York City that we do to try to support smaller people, smaller purveyors and stuff, it kind of seemed like it was going in a direction that didn't feel I didn't feel really comfortable with. Mm-hmm. So I didn't know what you guys...
Is it a challenge, I mean, to be so far from farms and sourcing, and who picks up your garbage? What plumbing company do you use? Like, is there challenges towards running restaurants in that way?
Well, I mean... It's like anything, being, you know, communicating, but also being very involved. Because obviously, being a small business owner myself, I want to support the small business as much as I can. And so a lot of that is communicating, trying to stay on top of things, seeing what's seasonal, seeing what's kind of on the cutting edge, and being involved. And I think, you know, having the luxury of having a few restaurants and chefs who are very proactive and partners who are very much involved, it does allow us to do some research on our own and also try to support as much as we can, because, you know, I'm a huge fan of that.
So tell us about Beto. I mean, and now being in Brooklyn, like, give us some headlines on this new restaurant.
Well, we just opened up Beto about 2 weeks ago. It's at North 8th between Bedford and Barry.
Mazel tov.
Thank you. And it's basically what we wanted to do is kind of go back to Enoteca days from Remington and Ludlow and just kind of deliver that style. So basically... The food is a small plate, Italian-inspired, you know, kind of goes into, it's extended from Italy into some other parts of Europe as well, because we want to kind of play around with the idea of serving some French wines and some Spanish wines and kind of giving Shauna the opportunity to play around with food outside of Italy.
Shauna Sargent, your
Shauna
chef?
Shauna Sargent, yes. She was she took over as a chef at Corsino about a year ago, and then when we started getting this plan together for Beto, you know, she's very much engaged with everything, food and wine. She's very involved, and it seemed like a great fit. And I really love having her there. She communicates really well. We talk about the whole animals all the time. To that point, with Beto, we have all the small plates in that, but we also have this part on the menu that's larger format animals that we obviously use the heritage food products.
Have pigs and stuff
like
that.
And so we've been having a lot of fun with that. Like each day we'll do a half a land animal and something out of the sea.
A half of a fish.
Yeah, exactly right. Well, we have parties of two. Like, you know, we have anything from like tile fish to black bass and things that are from Long Island.
Sort of family style?
Yeah. So basically someone will come in, a party of three, and they'll order, you know, we might be doing the Duroc pig, the milk-fed pig, or we might be doing the Cheshire. And then we bring out the, each table gets a few side dishes, and then Shauna will make a couple sauces to go with it. And then basically the animals roasted in the kitchen, kind of hacked up with a cleaver and brought out with some tongs. And it's just kind of meant for people to have a good time and really enjoy it. It's really simple. And just flavorful. I really enjoy it.
And are you selling that? Is that on specific days? Are you pre-selling that online?
No, 7 days a week. And, you know, with being involved in it for 2 weeks now, we're still kind of getting our foothold on that. But, you know, we've so far had, whether it's a party of two, we've had parties of 12. It was great the other night. We had a 12 top that six of them ordered the pig and six of them ordered the fish. So we had this big, beautiful fish that we brought out, presented it. Just brought a big serving spoon and this big giant hunk of pork, all the other pieces. And these people's eyes like kind of rolled. It was pretty awesome.
Yeah, it's nice to see food in its primal state versus all cut up.
And it's the interesting thing about that is chefs always try to tweak the same ingredients in small format, but how much you don't realize when you serve a pig, a whole pig, whatever, how captivating that is to a table, because no one really has seen that.
Once someone sees it go out, they're all like, oh, what's that? And it's interesting when you approach cooking an animal whole versus cooking it in different pieces, you find, you know, you're looking at different ways to cook it and different things that work better than others. But and it's also that argument of a pig that's milk fed and suckling versus something that's eaten from where it's lived, whether it's nuts and bark and you know, fruit for a year or two, and its meat develops a different flavor.
Totally. Well, I mean, this is a question I've always wanted to ask you, and I always said that because it's in the same vein. I always remember Jason telling me restaurants cannot wait more than 5 minutes before getting a drink into your hand. And I felt so liberated to feel that, because when I go to a restaurant and I'm wanting to spend, you know, $14 on a cocktail waiting for 40 minutes.
Right.
So what do customers want?
Yeah.
Because you're the king of that. Also, the timing of things. So speak to that.
Now, do you mean in the sense of like cocktails in general moving towards...
Well, no, because I did want to talk about your unbelievable fruit cocktails, which I thought really broke new ground in Enoteca Uptown. But like, what do customers want? I mean, they basically want a fun, honest...
Well, you know what's funny is when people ask me what Beto was, or can you give me a description? And, you know, you always get in that small plates or it's large plates. Or we just wanted to open up a restaurant that we like to eat in. So the food's like we like to cook, the drinks are like we like to drink, and that's kind of it.
You just having fun with it?
Yeah, we're having a good time with
it. So tell us about the cocktails, for instance.
Well, the cocktails, you know, we have a lot of the standards.
We were talking about the Negroni.
Yeah. You know, originally we were going to do seasonal Negronis or Negronis that change all the time. And it, for me, once we started, it felt a little too gimmicky. So we just kind of pulled back and just went right to the basics. And, you know, I love a great Negroni. That's kind of what I always, my aperitivo go to.
Are you drinking a Negroni in December, though, or are you wait till
I'm
the spring?
I'm definitely drinking a Negroni in December.
Fair enough.
But I might tap into a little tequila in the summer, but I always...
You do like tequila.
Slime. Yeah.
So, but what was unusual about your cocktails? They seem to be very fruit juice based or very farm fresh or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think a lot of the bartenders these days call themselves bar chefs or, you know, you name it, but they're very involved. And at any given day, the guys are back there in the kitchen when Shauna's ordering, whether it's Shauna at Beto or, you know, Steven over at Enoteca Uptown, where we have a pretty extensive cocktail program. You know, the bartender will be in there saying, okay, I need this fruit. And when you order this fruit, I need this. And they're, you know, between squeezing juices, making bitters every day. Right now we're working on our Amaro at Beto. So I have this like giant vessel that's starting to get filled with everything from bark to dried nuts and you name it.
And you're right about that. The mixology sort of thing that's happened has one positive thing. It's brought the front of the house and the back of the house a little bit closer.
I couldn't agree more.
Yeah. In terms of just procurement and just, you know, maybe sort of there's a reduction of blueberries or huckleberries and they need the kitchen to do it and the bartenders aren't on the shift at that time.
Right.
So the kitchen takes it on.
I mean, you brought up a good point because so many times people use the old adage, front of the house or back of the house. And I don't see it that way. I see it as one seamless family and If one part falls, then it affects the whole place. So don't keep them separate. Pull them together, and everybody works together better.
Do you think you feel that way because of the back of the house experience you have in San Francisco, or just in terms of how your philosophy of your restaurants and how you like to run them?
Well, I mean, to me, it was just a priority to make sure that they're all together because I, you know, as much as I love cooking and could cook, you know, every day, there's people that are probably better than me at certain things. So it's like you want to get them empowered, have them be creative, and also be a part of it so, you know, everyone can communicate and work together.
Very interesting. So are people copying you now? Because you must have been one of the first places. I mean, Alice Waters introduced me to your place, Eno, downtown for the first time. And she just said it was so unique and trend-setting, and ironically, just by doing simple things like with an egg or, you know, with a simple panini. And so now that's all over the place.
Yeah,
so.
But I mean, I think copying's tricky in the sense that I'm not the first person to ever do a panini.
Really? I thought that was... Or you were the margarita pizza.
Margarita. Yeah. No, but I'm saying, you know, so I think, you know, that stuff, it's basically... I've picked up ideas from other people as well, and I think the trick is, or not the trick, the idea is you want to put your stamp on it.
Yeah.
So I've been, I think part of the idea of going out to all these great restaurants around is you want to find something that you like, and I don't know, for me, I like to make it my own. So find a way to make it.
You know, yeah,
special.
Exactly. You don't want to use the word, you know, branding is a weird word to use in some restaurants. It's so typical to say. So. But you like to have sort of your signature on.
Yeah, and I think as far as copying, I think everyone's looked at someone else's combination of things and whether they figure out how to do it differently or in their mind make it better. We're not ever looking to copy anybody, but I think the idea is you learn from other people and you try to figure out what works best for you.
Where Eno is the last sort of stronghold of that last generation of Italian Americans that are living in the West Village, that generation. And we talked about this before.
Yeah,
my uncle, who's probably about 80 years old. He's probably eaten out 15 or 20 times his entire life.
Right.
I walked by 2 weeks ago. And I see him once in a while. Hey, you're still at that place all the way on the east side? And it's like
two blocks away.
It's another world, right. I'm like, yeah. He's like, oh, you got to go to that place around the block. I'm like, what place? Eat. I'm like, really? He's like, amazing food.
And so, are you like me? Do you find the state of the sandwich to be in bad? I mean, because if his uncle never goes out because the food's bad in his mind, and then yet he goes to Eno. I mean, what is the state of American sandwiches? Like, are you disappointed most of the time when you go out somewhere?
No, I mean, contrary to completely, because I feel like this whole sandwich push over the last 5-10 years has really opened up the doors from like Bami to you name it. I think the international approach to sandwich has become more viable because I think people look at it as more of a meal, whether it's the way the economy went for a period of time and people wanted to look to save a little bit of money, or they wanted to have more of a casual approach to their meal. I think the sandwich is better now than it's ever been, and I think it's more interesting to people because you have all these great chefs from around the world who want to make a sandwich.
Yeah.
So
that is nice. It's kind of like the high chefs going low and the low chefs going high. I mean,
I mean
high culture, low culture, like a sandwich would be considered
keeping everybody
regular
on their toes.
Food. Yeah, yeah, no, it makes, I think it is the true challenge. Less of the margin of error, harder it is to do, you know?
Right.
Well, anyway, we're going to take a little break. And if Julia is at Roberta's ordering a drink, we'll come back with a Julia and Jason section.
Thanks, guys.
Perfect.
Si beve whisky and soda, o te sente disturbato. Tua ballo rock and roll, tu giochi al baseball, ma sol te becchi a me. Chi te li dà la borsetta di mamma? Tu vuoi fare americano, americano, americano. Ma se non vorrei lì, sentami, non c'è sta niente a fa. Ok, napoletano, tu vuoi fare americano, tu vuoi fare americano. Quando se fa l'amore sotto la luna, come te viene capo di allo più.
Ok, together.
Tu vuoi fare l'americano, americano, americano. Se non è chi tu fa, tu vuoi vivere alla moda, ma si beve whisky and soda, poi ti senti disturbato. Tu abbandono rock and roll, tu gioca a baseball, ma i soldi becca me. Chi te li dà? La borsetta di mamma. Tu vuoi fare l'americano, americano, americano. Ma sei nato in Italia, se da me non c'è sta niente a fa. Ok, napoletano. Tu vuoi fare l'America, tu vuoi fare l'America, tu vuoi fare l'America.
Right.
And we're back.
We're back with the lovely Julia from Employees Only. I have a bio to read here.
Read it. You memorize all this stuff.
Okay, this is just off the top of my head. Julia is the chef of Employees Only. She grew up in an Eastern European butchering family in Wisconsin. Julia is one savvy culinarian. Just 24 years old, is that right? She is the executive chef of Employees Only, a New York City restaurant in the West Village. Her menu features all the trendy stuff like braised beef, cheeks, bone marrow poppers, duck confit, but her style is influenced by her Croatian-American heritage, showing up in a charcuterie plate of smoked and cured Eastern European meats and chicken liver pate and specials like, Jack, for your tagging purposes, it's spelled just like it sounds. Plajeskavaka.
Oh, so hot right now.
Or Balkan hamburger. And Same with this. There's an E at the end of this one, Jack. Tufa hije, or Bosnian poached apples in the French style, and others.
I like it. I like it more in the Spanish style, but that's just me.
Welcome, Julia.
Hi.
Welcome back.
I know. It's been a while.
Yeah? Did you have trouble waking up and getting in here?
Do you see these eyes right now?
Were you working late or partying?
I was. I was working.
Julia, are you the 414 or the 262?
414.
Oh, I know. Old school. House, Milwaukee.
Old school.
Nice. 414. It's true. So tell us a little bit about, since we have Jason here, who's one of the kings of bringing, you know, Italian charcuterie to America and to New York in a very accessible kind of environment. Tell us a little bit about Eastern European charcuterie and the process and the styles and some of the famous products.
Okay. So obviously growing up in Milwaukee to a Croatian family, a lot of the charcuterie I ate growing up was in Eastern European style, which is cured, but then also always heavily, heavily smoked, and usually much more heavily salted than other types of charcuterie. So I, at Employees Only, it's a great kind of place to be able to bring that style to the public. And one of our owners is Bosnian and one is Serbian, so they all kind of get it with me. So, and I source from a few guys in Astoria that do the same sort of process.
Same things, the same cuts? Like they're taking a ham and curing
it? You know, and they do like the special, Kulin is a meat I always have on my charcuterie board, which I think you've had before. That's that really paprika, garlicky kind of sausage that is a little bit of like a, has a little bit of a cult following, especially in Croatia, where every family has their own Kulin recipe and they have Kulin festivals and, you know, everybody kind of competes of whose Kulin is best and yada, yada, yada.
My Kulin kicks are Kulin's ass.
Exactly.
Your dad was a butcher, right? Do you think that's why you want to lean towards that stuff?
Yeah. And, you know, we ate charcuterie for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. So.
Oh, man. That's awesome.
Kind of one of those.
Julia is not morbidly obese, by the way, for our listeners. She's not.
True Atkins diet.
Eating, yeah, well, that's true, actually. Meat. Well, that is one of our questions later.
TCM1 or TCM2? What are the different? What are your favorite curing styles? Or do you have any sort of specific that you lean towards? Or
I think, you know, I've learned a lot of different techniques. I mean, it's funny. It's even like, my dad was in town 2 weeks ago, and he cooked with me at Meatopia, and it was funny because I took him around the city to try all these different kinds and ways, and there was a few people doing, you know, whole hogs, and he always makes me laugh because he's, you know, when people kind of, when they put all the brines into the hogs and they're injecting, and, you know, he's like, what the heck are these people doing, you know, and like, I mean, they just like straight up salt. And yeah,
just,
and that's it. There's no
simple.
Yeah, very, very simple.
And they have a facility in Milwaukee.
Yep.
That does curing, like a curing room.
Yeah. Instance. Well, they up north in Wisconsin, they have a few smokehouses, so they bring everything. They do everything up north and then bring it down to the city.
Not to be boring on this, but I can get very boring when it comes to charcuterie because I really love it. But what do they do? Like, is it a cold? I mean, is it a very warm, muggy environment?
It's a hot. I mean, so they brine it, or they just salt pack it for a few days, and then wash it and hang it in a hot smoke, and then they put it into a cool room to dry.
And they hunt the animal sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And what can you hunt up there?
Deer. My uncle has a cattle farm, and
love hunting cattle. It's one of my
favorite. They're easy. They don't run very fast.
Yeah, they don't go very fast.
Quick. Just sit in a tree for 3 hours.
And that's it.
That's really
Yeah, just, I mean, hunting deer, but then they do, you know, all the
bear?
They don't hunt bear. My dad said a few bears come to his shop, but they don't really
come. They buy from them.
Yeah, they just, you know, they stop by. And
so, Jason, I wanted to ask you, bringing you in, like, you were 13 years, right? Is your oldest restaurant here?
Eno, 98, fall of 98.
So, since you were serving a lot of cured meats, mainly the Italian kind, can you talk about curing culture in the USA and how it's changed?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, Mario's father, I think when I first started at Poe, he had just started taking that course, in the Bronx or something. This was 13 years ago or so.
Mario Batali.
Mario Batali. And I think that was kind of our first step into it. We'd been buying salumi at, or, you know, Mario and Steven had been buying salumi at FICO forever. And, you know, with Eno, when it opened up, I think Mario kind of established that whole antipasti and affettati. And so that was just kind of a natural progression to put it on the menu. And before that, I didn't really have that much knowledge about it, but it was kind of a quick ramp up from Eno to Lupa, and then we really kind of embraced the whole curing program. And, you know, I don't know how many animals we went through trying to get the recipes right, because it was kind of in the moment and putting it together, but it was a lot of fun just seeing the process.
Julie, do you think, coming from Wisconsin is such a major provider of food in this country, do you think it's talked about as much as it should be? Or because I don't think a lot of Americans realize how much stuff comes out of...
Yeah, I don't either. I don't think it's talked about very much, to be honest.
I mean, do you think there's a particular reason for that? Or because it's just not, it's a, you know, not in a sort of a glamorous kind of destination or whatever you want to call it? Or do you
I've never really thought about it. No, I mean, I'm not really sure why.
What are the big brands to come out of Milwaukee?
I mean, you have to realize
Harley
Davidson, Kohler, Sinks.
Ah, yeah.
Milwaukee's best.
Milwaukee's best. Yes, Jason. Well, also, this is a sad thing. I probably shouldn't bring it up, but serial killer capital of the world, Jeffrey Dahmer.
Absolutely, Ed Gein.
Milwaukee Brewers is owned by the
Ed Gein. Who's he? The maitre d' at Canal Bar? No. I was quoting American Psycho.
Sorry. Oh, really? Jack, I can't believe you didn't come on with a clip from American Psycho in that 1 second interval. No, but Milwaukee's a very interesting place. I mean, is it Rishi Tea is there, this big tea company that sells to Whole Foods?
I mean, all the cheeses that come
out. But are there big companies?
That's cheeses.
I mean, corn. The Italian market is affected by Wisconsin because it produces so much sort of comparative,
right? Like more mainstream
stuff, and they undercut Italy so much. A lot of the smaller restaurants that don't care about quality will buy from there. So,
right, you know,
America's Dairyland.
Absolutely. Right? Because Dairyland is trademarked by this big company.
That's true.
But talking about this would be interesting to hear from maybe Wisconsin's point of view in New York. I mean, how do you guys react to people who say Americans should eat less meat? Because, I mean, are your restaurants healthy?
Are you asking me? Or?
Yeah, both of you guys. These are both questions for all of you.
I mean, I guess for me, it's all about balance. I mean, if you eat a little bit of meat and eat a little bit of vegetables, and, you know, there's nothing wrong with it. I mean, I don't think so.
What if you eat meat 7 times or 14 times a week?
Well, I think if you broaden the style of meat, if you have 7 steaks a week, I think it's a lot different than having a little bit of chicken, a little bit of pork, a little bit of beef, a little fish. I think, you know, all those things.
Yeah, I think, I agree. I think Americans should eat less meat, you know, and I think it should be more balanced with other things, you know, because I think if you're eating 7 steaks a week and you're just eating 7 steaks and you're not eating any vegetables or any other food group along with that, you know.
But do you put any effort into making your dishes healthy? Like if someone orders a steak, would you put a side of broccoli rabe on there just to be
Yeah, absolutely. I think it all has to be balanced always. Yeah.
But I think healthy is also the responsibility of the guests. I mean, you want to order properly. You know, some places, if you order a steak, it's just going to come with a steak. So what else are you going to do to be proactive and taking care of yourself?
Yeah, absolutely.
Polino's, that's not healthy. Pizza, meats.
I know, we try to, you know, source properly.
So now I want to get into this. Jack hates playing this because he's heard this 100 times, but I would like you both to react to this clip that we're about to hear and tell us how it relates to you.
Hey guys.
Hello.
Hi, hello.
My name is Dana. I'll be taking care of you today. If you have any questions about the menu, please let me know.
I guess I do have a question about the chicken, if you could just tell us a little bit more about it.
The chicken is a heritage breed, woodland-raised chicken that's been fed a diet of sheep's milk, soy, and hazelnuts.
Okay, this is local?
Yes, absolutely.
I'm going to ask you just one more time, and it's local.
It is.
Is that USDA organic or Oregon organic or Portland organic?
It's just all across the board, organic.
The hazelnuts, these are local?
How big is the area where the chickens are able to roam free?
I'm sorry to interrupt. I have exactly the same question.
4 acres. Give me just a second. I'll be right back, okay?
Okay.
Okay.
Which is nice.
We're doing the right thing.
I'm too apologetic.
You are.
I drove way too slow here today, didn't I?
Yeah.
I'm so weird with that gas pedal. The thing just moves the whole vehicle forward.
All right. So here is the chicken you'll be enjoying tonight.
You have this information. This is fantastic.
Absolutely. His name was Colin. Here are his papers, okay?
That's great. He looks like a happy little guy who runs around. A lot of friends, other chickens as friends. Putting his little wing around another one and kind of like palling around.
I don't know that I can speak to that level of intimate knowledge about him. They do a lot to make sure that their chickens are very happy.
When you say they, I mean, who are these people raising Colin?
It's a farm that's located about 30 miles south of Portland.
And you have a good relationship with this farm?
We do.
It's not some guy on a yacht who lives in Miami.
Oh, goodness, no.
Saying that he's organic.
It tears at the core of my being the idea of someone just cashing in on a trend like organic.
No, I know the type. No.
Yeah.
Tell you what, we're going to go check it out if you don't mind. If you could hold our seats.
Oh, now?
Yeah. We'll be right back. We'll just make sure.
Thank you so much, Dana.
Sure.
All right.
Portlandia, everything you love and hate about the restaurant industry right there.
So are customers getting wiser, more sophisticated, or more annoying, or none, neither? I pose it to both of you.
Yeah, I think obviously that's the extreme Saturday Night Live version. But I think it's up to us to be responsible. And I think for at a certain point, you know, it's important for the guests to be inquisitive to a point.
It's funny because you always run into an obstacle when you try to do the right thing, where volume becomes an issue, and you put something on the menu, and you're buying it from a smaller farm, and then all of a sudden they run out, which is perfectly reasonable. But you can't. I mean, so you have to sort of find that balance, whether it's through specials or whatever.
Right.
But I always find that that's the issue with sort of socially aware procurement.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and I think people are. Customers are definitely more inquisitive, and as more information comes out through the media, you know, these questions come out. And I'm not sure that, you know, it's such a large topic, and so with so many facets, you know. So I think people do ask those questions for sure, but whether or not they understand the whole realm of it, you know,
I guess that's a good question. Do they understand the questions that they're asking?
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah.
And whether does it make sense? Whether it's organic versus local versus, you know, I think as long as we can do our best to kind of present a very responsible dish, then that's, you know, that's what we're trying to do.
Right.
Well, very nice. Well, I mean, talking about, you know, staying true to trends and stuff, I mean, how do you both stay current, you know, and mix things up, but still stay true to your old standard dishes, you know, that have gotten you core customers, or that your customers keep returning because they love, but you also don't want to get typecast? And I mean, how do you deal with new and old?
Like the steak tartare.
Yeah, steak tartare
like
is not going
steak
anywhere.
Steak tartare. Speaking of. I mean, it's a hard one because I personally feel this internal pull and tug all the time because there are things on the menu that I just can't take off, you know, because...
Too popular.
I mean, the owners, you know, not allowing me to, in a sense, because people come back for these things. And, you know, I think it's just this, you just kind of have to be okay with it. And doing specials and, you know.
Getting that creative element.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, using those kinds of ways to.
Yeah. I guess for me, like I have the, for each restaurant, it has, you know, maybe 20 or 25% are things on the menu that someone is going to recognize, whether they come in now or 10 years from now. And it's like that level of comfort that they know that they can rely on that. And then the other 75% is where I allow the chefs to be flexible during the season to really let them kind of grow and do things that are going to enable them to have a great time and deliver their stamp on something. So it's that balance of having structure that this is what we're going to do, and then this is what you can do to have fun with it as well.
And employees only, I mean, your majority after like 11 o'clock is all industry people. So, I mean,
that feels,
I mean, just in general of accommodating with the hours, it just feels good to have.
Right. And the great thing, I mean, and then after, you know, we do switch menus late night. So that kind of allows me to be a little bit more it's not as structured as the dinner menu. You know, the late night menu is kind of a little bit more fun, more drinking food, smaller plates. So I get a lot more room to play
and have fun.
I had one of my best eating experience, best restaurant moments ever. I was, my friend's in the music industry, and he got us backstage tickets to see the Rolling Stones. And at the end of the concert, three or four of the, you know, back band members and the tour manager came out, and they were like, "Where's a place we're sure to find room?" And like, I don't know why I said employees only. But
Lots of room there.
I literally across, this was back in the old days with the two core guys with the long mustaches, and I literally mouthed them, "Five people, Rolling Stones." And I swear, in the most full bar in the history of the world, within 3 minutes, there was a six top and Rolling Stones was playing on the radio. And how they did that with that little backspace. At the time, they still had the garden, so it was a little easier. But
that's awesome.
I always remember how what a great front of the house that restaurant has.
That's great.
And how perceptive they are. But now, towards the kind of media world, because we're going to talk about Twitter feeds and websites and stuff.
No, you just hated Mary's Fish Camp if you follow his Twitter.
Oh, yeah, last night.
12 hours ago.
God, when does your research ever end?
Kalichi? Oh, you know, when your best friend is Charlie Rose, it's tough. You got to keep up with him.
So how does Yelp and websites help or hurt what you do? Well, we'll start with that.
You want to go, or I mean, for me, I think it's inevitable that they're there, from Yelp to anything, and I think you have to embrace it. And what we've done is just, you know, it's part of the world, part of social media, and that's how people react today and interact. So we just want to be a part of it. And you know, actually, just recently, over the last 6 months, I just got, you know, a Twitter feed, and it's by the way,
he's making quote signs with his hands.
No, but
everybody.
It's you know, Jay Denton NYC, and it's amazing the tools these days to be able to kind of get the word out. Like, we ran this Duroc pig the other day.
I thought it was a Chesterfield that you were running.
Maybe it was.
It's a Chester.
That was the one I made up. You know, but. But, you know, we ran it, and I did a tweet about it. And the next night, we're sitting there talking to this woman about the whole Twitter feed. And next to me is the guy that got the Twitter. And we were sitting there talking. And he's like, "Listen, I never would have come in without this feed." Oh. So it's kind of fun to, you know, develop the business relations that way as well.
Do you think, like, Yelp, what's your...
You're a step ahead of me. Yeah. I am. I still haven't tweeted. I'm not there yet. Yelp, I don't know. It's like that love-hate relationship, you know, because it's like, everybody has their own opinions, and that's what it's there for, and I think it's great to be there for that. But I love, every once in a while, I read Yelp, and there are dishes that I've never even cooked that are on Yelp. It's like, "Oh, I had the potato gnocchi." I'm like, "What?" I don't make that, you know?
But can they hurt or help you?
I think it helps. And I mean, I think that a few months ago I read this, a friend of mine forwarded me this Yelp review, and it was somebody went up to Stone Barns, and it was this woman had written this angry email about a fly had landed into her wine. And the waitress wouldn't say sorry for the fly being in her wine. Did you read that? And she got so angry and wrote this horrible review. And then, of course, it stirred all this. It's just like, you're eating outside and there are flies. And, you know, so it's like, I think that's like a great kind of example of how crazy people can be sometimes. And that it's, when I read reviews on Yelp or menu pages or whatever, you know, I think you have to take them a little bit with a grain of salt. And
It grounds you a little bit in the sense of, so, you know, we work in a sort of, in New York City, and you sort of get caught up. All your friends work in the restaurant industry, so you kind of lose touch with the general public, even though they're really well informed. And it kind of gives you a little bit of a grounding of, like, where you might stand with the public.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a good point. If you get one star... Obviously, I look at all of them. I don't look at all of them, but I go through on a regular basis. Maybe once a month, I'll take an hour and go through some different things.
What day was that? Who was on the table? Check the Avero sales. Check it. Who was that? Wait, what time?
Was that Durrock or Chester?
Table two on February 13th. Check. Wait. Yeah. They had the chicken. You didn't like the chicken. Who waited on that table?
You look for patterns, though, you know?
Yeah.
But...
Do you ever look at plates as they come back into the kitchen?
As much as we can. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Do the waiters keep the place numbers and they're like, "This was position 3"? If it's a VIP
table? If they didn't
table?
Eat it.
Yeah, I think you... I think too, I mean, when you're doing specials and things that have possible menu slots, you know, you kind of watch and see what's coming back and what's being eaten. I think it's really important too, not only when you're making a dish, obviously the taste and the way it looks, whatever, but how, you know, is it easily edible, you know, or mm-hmm. how are people eating it when it's coming back? Like if you're leaving something on the bone, you know, like the Porterhouse pork chop of yours that we use, mm-hmm. you know, there's that little nugget of meat on the side. And sometimes I was noticing it was really, really coming.
That's the best piece of meat.
Yeah. And it kept coming back. So, you know, I'll just
now,
relaying
that. Disconnect
the,
it before. It,
no. So now, I mean, it's just.
Just
tell people to eat it. I mean, the way that I solved that issue was tell the way, exactly, in pre-meal, bring, you know, have everyone try it. This is the, you know, so then it engages, you know, the servers with the tables more. Like, this, you need to eat this.
At the best French 3-star restaurants, they put a little flag that says, eat me. So that always works.
That's exactly what we do as well. Like, if there's a dish that maybe needs to be mentioned, a certain part of it that mm-hmm. might not look that spectacular or something that right. people need to eat, it's like you got to point it out, right. and then they eat it and they're like, holy shit.
Absolutely.
So what media sources are important to you guys? Like, let's say Beto's opening, where do you want that to be seen? Or if they're gonna, you know, honor you with a 5-year you know, she's been working at Employees Only for this long, it's still maintained all its quality. Like, what are the ones that you, food publications or media sources that you really look up to and admire or want to be a part of?
I think the things that I think the blogs are, you know, an important kind of way where it's industry and public are reading, you know, so it's both, you know.
Yeah, I think that's important. But also in New York, you know, you've got New York Magazine, and
is that,
you know,
the best one? Like a New York Magazine article leads to the most.
You know, I've always been a fond of New York Magazine, and also
it's one of the best magazines I think out there.
Yeah, I think it's really I think it's a balanced magazine that covers a lot of things about New York City, and you know, obviously everyone always looks at a Times piece as like a mm-hmm. the review is like
a big deal.
Yeah. Yeah, you turn to traditional Wednesday sort of stuff. But
have it's almost such a unique type of restaurant because it's a full experience and yet the food is like old standards. Like, it's funny, I don't remember.
Yeah, the Eno was a 25 and under Asimov review like 13 years ago. But Enotecas, you know, kind of, what am I digging myself into right now? And the Enotecas haven't been reviewed, or Corsino.
Strange to me.
So, you know, I think that's kind of like, I always shoot for more of neighborhood spots that are maybe, I don't know.
But Julie, you guys have a pre-theater menu on your,
what theater is it? The Cherry Blossom?
I couldn't figure out.
We don't have it anymore.
It's on the website. Sorry.
Research is too good. Like, let me see our homepage.
I think we just took it off.
Six hours ago, it was still on there.
So, let's talk about Twitter and Facebook and all. So, do you have a website, Jason, for all your restaurants?
We do. It's Eno Family of Restaurants. Well, actually, it's Enoteca NYC, and then that kind of loads everything on there.
I-N-O, no apostrophe.
Yeah, it's just Enoteca NYC.com, and that kind of just goes to, you know, kind of an overview of the restaurants. It has, like, you know, the Jay Denton NYC Twitter feed that I'm big in right now and really enjoying. It kind of gives you a catalyst to the other places.
Cool. And Twitter, what's your, how do people tweet you? They can just search you, right?
If they just go Jay Denton NYC and they can click on and follow me, that's always a fun, you know, because we do, not only is it like a vehicle for additions and stuff like that, it's kind of stuff about thoughts and what's going on in food and wine and new things I'm tasting or trying or people that I've met that inspire me and stuff like that. So I have fun with it.
People, listeners, if you can be at Roberta's in the next 18 minutes, you will see Jason Denton at the bar eating a, you can touch him. No, you don't even need to tweet him.
Well, just, no eye contact.
That's no eye contact.
Direct eye contact.
Well, any other messages, Jason, before you head back with your family? Any events that we should, people should be coming to Beto. It's the newest restaurant.
We just opened that up a couple of weeks ago and having a lot of fun with it. I'm basically there every night.
Coming
a week.
From Manhattan, what's the best train to
get there? Yeah, it's the first stop off the L when you get to Brooklyn. So if you're taking the L, the first Brooklyn stop, you just get off at Bedford Street, walk one block down on North 8th Street, and you're right there. It's kind of tucked away into a little spot there, but...
Or you just take the Williamsburg Bridge by car.
By car, yeah.
And you're right there.
And you take the first right off the first exit, Broadway, and then take your right on Bedford.
What is that big table, your big communal table, what does that weigh, like 2,000 pounds?
I thought you were going to ask me what the name of it was. Oh, no. I don't know.
It's the largest single piece of granite or whatever it is that I've ever seen in my life.
It's granite?
Cement.
Cement.
But, you know.
As heavy. Well, Jason, thank you so much.
And, no, thank you so much for having me on as a guest. It's been great.
Hopefully you'll come on again, and we want Sean over here and Liz and your whole crew.
Anytime. Thanks, guys.
Very cool. Hey, we'll be right back with another segment with Julia.
Before we go to break, I have one Yelp review.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
What is it? Read it. For which restaurant?
You'll figure it out.
Food Lover 101.
I love the vibe of Roberta's. It's so DIY and industrial. The huge shipping containers are rad, and I was jealous of the people who were chilling in the radio station, one with a Coors and a bunch of pizzas. Very VIP.
Oh, cool, man.
That's awesome.
Amazing.
Very cool. Thanks, Jack. Yes. All right, well, we will be back in a minute with Julia.
Okay. Are the fiddlers ready? All right, let's launch it.
This is a public service announcement from Heritage Radio Network. Every Tuesday at noon, Dave Arnold, the author of CookingIssues.com, will discuss new and innovative techniques, equipment, and ingredients. Call in with your own questions to see if Dave and the crew can solve your cooking issues. Again, that's Tuesdays at noon on the Heritage Radio Network.
And we're back here at Roberta's on this beautiful sort of semi-cloudy, semi-sunny Sunday morning here with the chef of...
1 o'clock is not morning, by the way.
Whoa.
1 p.m. is no longer morning.
I will... Morning. Julia, is this your morning? Julia, is this your morning?
This is definitely my morning.
We're here with...
This is 9 a.m.
with the chef of employees only, Julia Jessic. Just talking now a little bit about employees only, your sort of career... can you touch a little bit on when you worked at Soho Grand? Because that was probably... Yeah. You were there for about 3 years.
Yeah,
and,
it was.
And it was kind of at the point where it was really one of the first boutique-y hotels.
Yeah, absolutely.
And what they were doing.
Yeah, I just moved here, and I really wanted to experience a large operation. You know, so you have a restaurant and room service. It's a 24-hour kitchen. And, yeah, it was... definitely like one of the first downtown boutique hotels. Lots of very interesting kind of programs going on. And I got to meet some of my best friends there.
People that you just came up with in working in the kitchen and, and stuff. What years were you there?
Is it 2003 to 2007?
So like right around the middle of So I think it opened in 96.
Yeah.
What did you do there?
I started as a line cook and then moved my way up.
Nice.
And really established a lot of Missy Robbins, one of my great friends. Yeah. She was there. John DeLucy was there. Amanda Freitag. So I got all these great friends.
It's just crazy because everyone's first restaurant job in New York City, it's always sort of a incubator, and all the people that you work with all go on to do amazing things.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, the most amazing example of that was the Danielle Boulud Kitchen, I guess, in the late 90s. It had Michael Anthony from Gramercy Tavern, Riyad and Lee. And then there's like, I'm not exaggerating, like four other guys that I'm not remembering right now. But it was just like a hotbed of activity.
When Danielle left Le Cirque, his opening team at Danielle, that kind
of
like...
Or one of after his
a few years, that was sort of, his alumni. That's
it was
amazing.
Just how they all went to powerful things. So, it's an interesting, that collaboration of starting. So, is that usual to stay in touch with your first kind of job?
My first gig was at Tribeca Grill. And now the alumni from there, one of the people, his name's Greg Ryan, he's a maitre d' at Per Se. Another person is the general manager at Forkin' for the Franks. I think he's doing down Frankie's 457. Another guy opened a restaurant called Persephone in Midtown. It's a Greek restaurant. So, these are guys.
They're like Persephone, Per Se for short.
If you can't get in there, go to the Greek restaurant.
They're like, dude, this isn't Per Se.
And so, you come up and you're all being underpaid, but learning a lot in your first places. And then you go on a lot of different things and you like look at each other like 4 or 5 years later and kind of like, pinching yourself like, wow, this is so weird.
So now, is it obviously Employees Only is big on bar? So, is there an exchange between the kitchen and the bar?
Yeah, I first I'm going to give a little shout out. We had Tales of the Cocktail.
Ooh,
2 weeks ago.
Nola. You were at the Templeton House?
Wasn't present. I did not go, but our whole bar staff went, and we actually won best bar in the world.
What?
Jack, whoa, that was weight.
Jack, I thought he was anti-sound effect.
Look at that.
That was perfect.
That's the iMovie clap one.
We had Steven on here on Damon's show. Yeah, they were celebrating that last week.
Do you have any clips of that, Jack?
Maybe.
All right. Well, if you do find a clip, that is amazing. Number one bar in the world.
I don't know what that means.
What do you win?
Yeah, that's crazy.
We won this beautiful Asprey glass plate.
Who sponsored the event?
I'm not very sure of the specifics. I just know it's like this. It's a big kind of brand. You know, all the liquor brands and the liquor world.
There's so much money.
They're all there. Yes.
Wow. Number one bar in the world.
And we won it. What was the other? We won another award. Best drink selection in the world.
You have a four to six page drink menu. Yeah. Each cocktail is its own world. I mean, I always remember these delicious cherry ones. I mean, you felt like you were drinking a dessert, and as a result, you could get really drunk there.
There's really a lot of trial and error with all those cocktails. It's not just like, let's think of a witty name and throw a few things together.
No, and I mean, it's great too because those guys are. They really take what they do seriously, and so even just, I think they just kind of like, going on a whim, and when if someone comes to the bar and they ask them, what's your favorite spirit, and then they'll in what kind of flavors is sweet, not sweet, and they can kind of just, I think they have the most fun just kind of coming up with stuff on the fly.
Do they order stuff? Do they ask you to order stuff?
Yeah,
them?
So my relationship with them, we definitely work together. I help them with... We do a lot of our own infusions and cordials and purees and stuff like that. So there's a lot of back and forth between us, and they're... Especially when they're working on new cocktails, flavor combinations. Like, just yesterday we were working on a new drink with Saint Germain, and we're doing a saffron infusion.
Ooh, what are you charging for that?
Kind of.
Do big companies, like big liquor companies, go to you guys and say, "Can you make us a, you know, Glenfiddich, you know, drink?"
Yeah, I mean, it's a big deal for.
Does that compromise the quality sometimes?
No, not necessarily. I mean, it's also, these liquor companies put bids, you know, to have a drink with their liquor on the menu. And, you know,
bids, so, you mean they offer just the bar money?
Not is just money, not bid? Money,
no,
but...
So technically, that's illegal. Yeah, so I doubt that.
But I mean, for like a sale.
They might give them an allocation on something really esoteric, like Rittenhouse Rye or something.
Right, right.
Only so, a small production.
But I mean, also to be a sales representative that has, you know, to be able to sell a drink with your liquor, you know, obviously there's, you know.
Because, you know, whoever is somewhere.
And I'm probably totally messing this up, by the
way.
No.
I mean, it makes total sense. People will click on, you'll see that you guys won that award, click on your bar menu and see what you guys have and copy. I mean, just like how every newspaper copies the New York Times every day.
Right.
You know,
right,
it's the same idea.
So
let's talk about food. Let's get back to my realm.
So, how long have you been there? In years?
Oh my gosh! I took a hiatus for a year, but I've been there since the beginning. So 7 years minus one, 6 years.
So has that neighborhood changed over the years?
Absolutely, especially lately. You know, a few years ago, a lot of places went out of business. A lot of the old school diners, and now all these things are starting to open. We have the guys from Frankie's are opening a place up the street.
Up north.
Corsino just recently, a year ago, I think.
You also have a lot of old standards, like the Cowgirl.
The Cowgirl from and Red Farm is opening. Yeah. Ed Schoenfeld's.
Oh, wow. So it's a real little hotbed now.
Lartuzzi 2 years ago. Yeah, there's a lot of new.
Is that good?
Lartuzzi?
No, I'm saying, is it good to see? I mean, it
yeah,
must be
no,
good
I
for
love
the
it. I love it. I think it's great.
It's
absolutely, I think it's great. I think, you know, it's a special little neighborhood over there, and I think, you know, all these places really contribute to it.
So, what's the greatest challenge of still being? I always think of like being somewhere for 7 years, and then I think about like all sports coaches. You know, like by the seventh, eighth year, it's hard to still speak to the team and motivate motivated. So, have you had to change your management style over the years to, you know, kind of adapt? And what is your management style? Because you're overseeing a large crew down
there. Yeah, I think I've learned a lot over the last 7 years, for sure. And I have a great team right now of guys that have been with me for, the last 3 years, 4 years. And, you know, I think, I don't know how I would necessarily classify my management style, but I think people learn things when you allow them to learn. So giving them the tools and letting them figure it out, you know, you can show someone something 100 times, but until they actually do it themselves, you know, they need to figure it out on their own.
So, this is my question I really wanted to ask. I asked this to you too, Jason. Is there competition amongst the chef world? Like, are you always like...
Well, there's that whole subgenre of competition going on, which is the most talented chef world right now, which is female chefs in New York City. I mean, April Bloomfield.
Are you being a misogynist right now? You're like, women chefs are catfighting?
No, I'm saying that they're doing amazing stuff in the city. They're finally getting recognition for it.
Because you're saying there weren't that many women chefs in the city before?
There were, but they're finally sort of getting some recognition, I feel like. And I think it started at the James Beard Awards like 2 years ago when they sort of, the whole premise of that show was women in food.
Huh.
And
which is funny.
It was Gabrielle Hamilton or Anita Lowe or April Bloomfield. I mean, it was a time when I was starting my career and I was a dog and I did every event. And every event I was at, I always saw Anita Lowe there, carrying stuff in, carrying stuff out. And then, so I feel, I mean, how do you feel about that? So I'm very passionate about that because I feel like they're doing amazing things. I wonder your thoughts on
yeah, that. I mean, I agree. I mean, I definitely think there are more female chefs, you know, and it's always an interesting kind of of course, I grew up with seven brothers, so
wow.
Yeah, so you know, you're like
Broadway musical.
Wait, are you the only girl?
I'm the only girl.
Wow.
So
what number are you?
One. So
you're the oldest?
I'm the oldest.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
Yeah, so I...
So were you the strong... Did you leave there the strongest ever? Or, I mean, how? What's it between you and the brother next to you?
Yeah, you know, I was,
could you ever kick all seven brothers' ass? Was there ever a time?
Not when they all ganged up on me at the same time. But, you know, there were a lot of, like, running around the house with fly swatters and knives and, like, you know. I held my ground. I held my ground.
Eight kids. Wow.
But... Yeah, you know, I think the competitiveness, I mean, I don't know if you have been as well, but I've been asked to do a lot of these competitive chef shows, you know, and I've always turned them down because I don't think I have a really strong competitive nature. Like, I would be the person on the show to help the competitor.
You would leave
like,
your station.
You need some help doing that. Okay, maybe I could fit that into my prep. You know,
you're very comfortable with what you're doing now, and you sort of you don't need validation from TV.
Right, absolutely. But I it's great though to a lot of my culinary friends are female chefs, and I just I think it's great to see, you know, all these female chefs kind of rise and kind of make a mark within the industry. But
so ironic, because if you look at chefing, I mean, people who cook throughout the world, probably 97% of them are women in the whole world, like mothers and throughout the world, all the different countries, and yet somehow ridiculously in the chef world, you know, in America,
the business aspect.
And I guess France too, right? I mean, there can't be that many. I always hear about French male chefs. So it just seems funny. Whereas in Italy, the osterias and stuff still have the old grandmother, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
It is strange. But, well, very cool. So do you have any menu things? I have been gifted a venison not for sale, hot sticks barbecue, Pernatz, Wisconsin, number 333.
It looks like a high-end Slim Jim.
It is very
nice.
That's
pretty much what it is.
I like the packaging.
Like I mentioned earlier, my father was here last week, and we did the Meatopia event, the hot, sweaty Meatopia event.
Yeah, it was
and,
like 101 degrees that day.
Wow. On a concrete pier.
Did a lot of people come?
There were quite a few, but I mean, it was... But my dad was here, and he brought... Way, way, way too much, as he does every
time.
He's
got to feed his daughter. He's like, you eat like a bird.
I'm like, 20 pounds of venison? What? What am I going to do with this?
But it stays fresh forever, right?
I mean,
for a long time.
For a long time. I mean, it's vacuum packed, so yeah, it'll stay fresh.
It's like a perfect pen holder.
Yeah. That's like my breakfast, usually a Slim Jim and two Excedrin.
Look at this marketing. They take this middle one out. You know, so it looks cool, but they also serve less.
There you go.
Very smart marketing in Wisconsin. So do you go back and do you hunt and cure with the fam?
I try to get back as much as I can.
Do your other brothers stay and work there?
I'm the only one, actually, that's left.
Really?
Left Wisconsin, yeah.
God, so independent.
Imagine. But it was great. It was funny having my dad here and taking him around. And, you know, I think he's just like, bright-eyed.
Yeah.
But he's like, oh, my God. Oh, my. And just all these different ways. Because what he knows is what he knows. I mean, earlier when we were talking about charcuterie, you know, when I really hadn't had other styles of charcuterie or other styles of cured meats until I started, you know, going to Chicago more often when I was a teenager and really exploring. And in Milwaukee, there's so much Eastern European and Northern European as well. But, lots of smoked stuff. So, yeah, until I really got to New York and started branching out and really researching all this, you know, all these different kinds of techniques, I knew one style. So it's interesting to have him here and be able to show him all these things that I've learned over the years.
Very cool.
Do you make it to Croatia ever? Or?
Yeah.
Isn't it weird how popular of a destination?
I know, it's really.
Does that freak you out a little bit?
Yeah,
the Italians have known that for years.
Well, but now the New York Italians know about it. And we're going to Croatia.
It's so funny that
that's your voice for anything, any place that people talk about.
It's
we're going to Croatia. The beaches there are gorgeous.
I talked to someone the other day who, you know, they have these cruises you can do from Italy, you know, across the Adriatic. And these people were like, you know, we were in Italy, and everybody was so nice, and then we got to Croatia, and I don't know, their attitudes were a lot different.
Oh, really?
Like, you know what, a little more Eastern Bloc, you know, so it's, but yeah, it's, the coast is definitely expanding and becoming more commercial, and, but yeah, I actually got in trouble. I haven't been in a few years, and when my dad was here 2 weeks ago, I definitely got a lecture of, you know, I was just in Vienna, and you know.
Oh, so you were right by there.
Yeah, and I got like, just rent a car and go. You have to go see your cousins. What the heck? You know, and all this stuff. So I try to travel as much. Yes, you know, as you were speaking earlier, being at Employees Only for 7 years, I think my one outlet, and I think the thing that kind of keeps me, you know, fresh and going and inspired is traveling, you know, so really making the commitment to leave, and whether it's, I'm kind of having a renaissance with America right now, but before that, it was definitely a lot of European stuff.
What's a dish from Croatia that you would see here in the U.S. that some people could
get a taste of your culture?
I think
mac and cheese.
There's, I think, you know, paprikash. I think a lot of people have like chicken paprikash, or there's a lot of Turkish and Hungarian and Austrian. There's a lot of that Ottoman Empire ruled part of the world. There's a lot of crossover. Paprikash for me is I ate it 4 times a week. It's a chicken stew almost with a paprika and sour cream, and we would eat it on mashed potatoes. Sarma, like a stuffed cabbage. I know a lot of people have had the Polish with the fresh cabbage with the meat rolled up, and the way we have it in Croatia is it's a pickled cabbage. It's rolled in pickled cabbage rather than
so if you
fresh.
So if you didn't get to the dinner table at whatever time that might have been, 6, right, and you were going hungry, right? Is that certain, that's that style of family?
Their parents would make sure.
Oh, they had the charcuterie all the time.
My grandmother always cooked like there were 100 people coming to dinner, so it was like.
So in terms of diet, you must have grown up eating meat. Certainly 7 nights a week, right?
In some capacity.
Absolutely. But a lot of vegetables, too. A lot of vegetables.
So it can be healthy. You think you can get away with eating meat 7 and 14 times a week, like lunch and dinner, but as long as you counter that with vegetables, everything's okay?
Not necessarily. I mean, we would eat meat for dinner, but for lunch, we wouldn't. I mean, but also, like, you know, this whole idea of using the whole animal and, you know, this...
Which you do use whole our animals out there?
Yeah.
And at Employees Only?
Yeah, we do. But, you know, it was like, I always think of my grandmother's basement and all the pickled, you know, all the parts that you couldn't cook or you couldn't free is pickled. And, you know, so growing up, you know, it was like you were eating, you know, maybe you were eating meat for lunch and for dinner, but it was the same animal, you know,
right,
it was like different parts of,
that's a, that's
of the
a
animal.
That's a unique experience growing up. I don't know many people that could say that they went into the basement and saw that kind of a thing. So those are
I ate all the parts of the animal in the form of a hamburger, which was an amalgamation of all
this. This is a kid who grew up in Manhattan.
And New York City hot dogs.
But now, you know, now...
Go to Grace Papaya.
Sabaret.
But currently, you know, at my days off, I don't eat any meat.
That's so good. Well, you look very healthy. I'm afraid that I'm just eating too much friggin' meat.
I have super high cholesterol, though.
Do you?
By the way.
That must be hysterical. Must be hysterical when you go to the doctor. What's this about?
What the hell?
What do you do for a living?
Oh, man. Well, thank you so much for coming on again. And, you know, this is a great way to start off our restaurant month.
This is a month of August. I will be here. I have neglected the beach for the entire month of August for this radio show. I will be in town every weekend.
That is awesome. I love that, Jason. You always come in. You're like, I've got something to say today. I'm like, what? The new meat recall? The debt ceiling? You're like, no. Mondays and Tuesdays, Wednesdays and Thursdays.
Industry, front of the house and back of the house, industry days off, like specific days off. Like if you have a really good cook, you're going to give him...
Well, let's ask.
Yeah, what would you give your best cook off?
What days do your best cooks
take? Monday, Tuesday.
Oh!
Count it!
No!
Front of the house manager is...
like if you have... I don't know if you guys... You have a GM there, I'm sure. Yeah. Who's there all the time and on call all the time. The AGM. What are the AGM, assistant general manager, whoever takes on the responsibility, what days do they have off?
They have off... We don't really have an AGM.
Or the person who takes on a lot of the responsibility.
What are his days off? His days off are Sunday, Monday.
Oh, oh man!
I don't make this stuff up.
Gold, baby. Well, we've been engineered by Jack Inslee and produced by Jack Inslee. I'm Patrick Martins.
Thanks, Jack.
Jason Colucci, Julia Jasek, and do you have a website, employeesonly.com?
Yeah, employeesonlynyc.com, and my blog, which I need to do more, Butcher's Daughter.
Butcher's Daughter.net. The last entry was 1997.
No, yes. It was still, a month ago.
Still very current. We'll be back next week with a bunch of chefs.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.
This is Behind the Scenes Food News with Katie Kiefer. The long-awaited documentary The Vanishing of the Bees will be screening in Astoria, Queens at the Broadway branch of the Queens Public Library on Monday, September 19th. I know that seems like a long ways away, but it isn't. It will be broadcast from 6 to 8 p.m. More information about this fascinating look at bee life and colony collapse disorder can be found at their website at www.vanishingbees.com. I also wanted to add that the producers are all working on a 30-minute educational video for high school students, so any parent or teacher should check out the site to see what he or she can do to work with the team to bring this into a school curriculum. The film has a Facebook page as well that discusses current events that affect bees. This is Behind the Scenes Food News with Katie Kiefer.